This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
One statistic by way of introduction today. General Motors has recalled more cars this year than it has sold. Think about that for just a second. Also, Vladimir Putin in China and the NSA as well. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, the 21st of May today. Great to have you with us, as always. You know how the West, broadly constructed, has been trying to economically isolate Vladimir Putin since that whole Crimea thing happened? How that was going to be the way to get him to back down? Yeah, no. Putin's in China this week for a state visit, and along the way today found time to sign a $400 billion natural gas deal with Beijing. It is, to quote Vladimir Putin himself, the biggest contract in the history of the gas sector of the former USSR. $400 billion for the Russian gas company Gazprom to supply the world's fastest growing energy market with a cleaner source of fuel. That would seem to make this a good time for us to offer a refresher on what exactly Gazprom is and why this deal matters so much. Sally Herships has it.
Gazprom is a company. It has a CEO. You can buy its stock. But ownership is a combination of private and state. And the state calls the shots.
Gazprom's key asset is the fact that if you're a gas producer in Russia, there's only one company you can sell your gas to, and that's Gazprom.
Keith Crane is director of the RAND Corporation's Environment, Energy, and Economic Development Program. He says the company has a reputation for mismanagement and corruption. Money that was supposed to be invested was ending up in some questionable hands.
I would not invest in it.
Crane says this deal with China is important. The European market is growing a lot more slowly, and with the tension between Russia and Ukraine, through which most Russian gas moves, European countries are looking for alternative sources.
China is the largest growth engine. It's the fastest growing consumer and importer of hydrocarbons, oil, and gas.
Andy Cutchins is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He says while oil makes up a large part of the Russian budget, keeping gas prices low for production and heating costs is critical for the country's domestic economy.
A good way to think about it is that for the Russians, they'll say, you know, oil, that's dengi, that's money. You know, but for gas, that's chleb, that's our bread.
Kutchin says Gazprom probably has rights to over 15% of the gas reserves in the world. And since it shares a border with China, this deal for gas should be a win for both countries. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Another day, another recall from General Motors. I say that like I'm kidding, but I'm really not. A couple of 100,000 subcompact Chevrolet Aveos for a potential fire hazard today. That's on top of a couple of million cars and trucks recalled yesterday for a whole bunch of different problems, which is, of course, on top of the big one, the ignition defects that have been linked to 13 deaths so far. And that in turn prompts this question: how many recalls is too many for consumers? Kate Davidson reports.
Clarence Ditlow of the Center for Auto Safety has been pushing automakers to recall unsafe vehicles for a long time. But GM recalling almost 14 million vehicles this year?
It's very unusual for any manufacturer to recall that many vehicles in just roughly 5 months of a year.
He says in the past, some companies thought it was cheaper to stonewall than to recall. But now, after Toyota's $1.2 billion criminal settlement over acceleration problems,
if you're in doubt about doing a recall, do the recall.
But what's the tipping point for consumers in this recall bonanza? One way to tell is through a website like Edmunds.com, where 18 million people shop for cars monthly.
For GM, shopper interest in their cars has not been affected by the recall.
Carol Locknett of Edmunds says this could be because a lot of the recalled cars aren't sold new anymore. Also,
in the majority of cases, the cars that people are looking at don't have the name GM on them. They're Chevrolets. They're Buicks.
So the brand identification isn't as strong. That's for new shoppers. But what about GM drivers? Robert Pasikoff heads the group Brand Keys, and he studies loyalty. He says GM's loyalty had been edging back after quality issues and the hit of bankruptcy. He recently surveyed the reaction of GM car owners who've had vehicles recalled.
And they were, of course, negative, but they were three times as large as brands where loyalty was high.
In other words, less loyalty going into a recall meant more unhappiness coming out. Pasikoff says that will show up in GM sales down the line. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
All kinds of happiness on Wall Street today. Green arrows all the way around. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Chinese state-controlled press is having a field day with the Justice Department indictments unsealed the other day, claiming the Chinese army is spying on American companies. High-level hooligan is among the choicer phrases used to describe this country, alongside countercharges that the NSA has basically been doing the same thing to Chinese companies. David Sanger is the national security correspondent for The New York Times, and he has been sorting through the many, many layers of this story, most recently in the paper today. David, it's good to talk to you again.
Great to be back with you, Kai.
I'm going to riff on the title of your piece in the paper today, Fine Line Seen in U.S. Spying on Companies. I wonder whether that line is between economic advantage and national security when the NSA goes poking around, huh?
Well, it is. And, of course, the American argument here is that when the NSA spies, it is spying either for pure national security, say it's hunting down terrorists or nuclear proliferators, or it is spying for some kind of national economic advantage. But they claim that when the Chinese spy, they're spying for specific corporate advantage. So the U.S. says if it goes into the computers of, say, Airbus, and of course it doesn't use this example, at least on the record, it doesn't then give the results to Boeing. It might give the results to trade negotiators, but it won't give it to Boeing.
Well, isn't it a little bit, and I can't be the only one thinking it, but it's a little bit like us saying, wait a minute, no, it's okay when we do it because we're the good guys.
Well, that may be what some people want to say, but instead their argument is a legal one, which is that no state enterprise should be spying on behalf of individual corporations, but all states spy on behalf of their national security. Now, the Chinese view is that they're the rising power and that economic security is part and parcel with national security, and that may well include getting corporate advantage, although they probably won't be willing to admit that in public.
Is part of the government, the U.S. government's defense line here, even if we were stealing economic secrets for economic advantage, we wouldn't know who to give it to. Do we give it to Google or Apple? Do we give it to Dell or Microsoft, you know?
That's exactly the argument. And, of course, their lawyers would add, if you gave it to Google, Yahoo would sue. If you gave it to Microsoft, you know, someone else. So you get the picture here. Now, in China, it's a lot easier because not only are there state-owned enterprises, but in many cases, the controlling interest is held by the People's Liberation Army.
With the full realization that this is fantasy and never going to happen, Don't you think maybe it would be easier if we all just acknowledged that we're all reading each other's mail like we did in the Cold War and got on with things?
Well, the reason that the U.S. considers that not an acceptable resolution here is that American companies are losing hundreds of millions or billions of dollars in stolen intellectual property. And frankly, the Chinese are not at a state of development where we're that interested in stealing their stuff, but they're highly interested in stealing ours. And so the cost in jobs in the United States, the cost in lost revenue, is very high for us, and it's been very low for the Chinese. So they view this as a way to force the Chinese into a discussion about what are our norms of operation in cyberspace.
David Sanger with the New York Times. David, thanks so much.
Thank you, Kai.
There was a market research report out the other day that I saw that said breast imaging is a nearly $2 billion industry in this country and growing at an annual rate of 12% a year. There are disagreements about when and whether to begin breast cancer screening, but the fact is that every year nearly 40 million mammograms are done in the United States. The Affordable Care Act has made screenings free for most insured women, but Lauren Silverman reports from KERA in Dallas that mammogram messaging still needs a little bit of help.
Scaring women about breast cancer is still the norm. Just listen to these PSAs.
1 in 8 women in the U.S. will develop invasive breast cancer at some point
during
their lives.
Every 2 minutes, there's a new breast cancer diagnosis.
These statistics are scary. More than that,
fear is not a motivator. It's typically something that will cause people to procrastinate.
Kate McGuire is president of Motivation Mechanics. It's a group of research and marketing strategists helping the largest breast imaging company in the country, Solis Women's Health, with a major makeover.
So we've, as a company, have made a decision, no scolding.
At its more than 24 locations across the country, Solis Women's Health doesn't just avoid scaring women, it avoids talking cancer at all. Women aren't called patients, and they're not having a cancer screening. They're visitors coming for a well woman exam. At its center in Plano, Texas, 80s love songs fill the dressing rooms. There are floor heaters for spa-style treatment. Everything is about avoiding anxiety. So if your test results are clear, you get an email, usually within 24 hours. If not, a phone call. Even the company's slogan is changing.
Our tagline was, annual mammograms, it's what smart women do, which is a bad girl message.
That's Greg Scott, VP of Marketing. Now the message is,
when you're ready, we'll be there for you, which is a lot different than it's what smart women do.
Scott says clever marketing and no copays under Obamacare are drawing women in. Last quarter, Solis Women's Health grew a healthy 4% nationwide.
I guess I'm always a little anxious when someone who has a strong financial interest is the one behind the message.
Steve Woolishin of Dartmouth says deciding whether to get a mammogram is much more complicated than a glossy brochure may suggest. While mammograms do save lives, they can also lead to false alarms and overdiagnosis.
The reason it's controversial is that the evidence supporting mammography, even though, you know, intuitively it seems like it's, you know, it's got to be the right thing to do, that finding things early is going to, you know, make things better. Unfortunately, the evidence that we have isn't so clear-cut.
Ultimately, he says, decisions on whether or not to get a mammogram should be individualized and based on knowledge, not fear. In Dallas, I'm Lauren Silverman for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Only about 3 to 4% of CEOs of public companies are women.
What's up with that? And when's it going to change? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials picked up 158 points today, 0.9%, closed at 16,533. The NASDAQ jumped 34 points, 0.8%, 4131. The S&P 500 added 15 points, about 0.8%, ended at 1888. Lots of retailers reporting this week. Tiffany the jeweler announced better-than-expected profits as shares were golden, up 9%. PetSmart, where you can, by the by, by Rhinestone College for your cat and dog, had lower than expected earnings and curbed its shares more than 8%. Curbed its shares, you see what we did there? American Eagle Outfitters, a mainstay of malls, fell 6.4% after saying we'll close 150 stores. General Motors added 1.1% today despite those four recalls we told you about. Bond prices down, the yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.53%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday. The National Association of Realtors reports on April sales of existing homes. The White House will host a ceremony for the new Harvey Milk Forever stamp in honor of Harvey Milk Day. And it was indeed a beautiful day in the neighborhood. On this day in 1967, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood premiered on PBS. I'm Daisy Palacios.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Financial disclosure regulations being what they are, you can find all kinds of things in a company's SEC filings. In a letter from December that came to light today, Google said it could imagine a future where ads would be delivered in some now, honestly, unthinkable places. Refrigerators, car dashboards, thermostats, and watches, just for starters. That would be pretty hard to ignore, but I'll tell you, when it's midnight and you want to get a snack from a refrigerator that happens to have an ad on it, oh, we'll find a way. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has the story.
Futurama is a show set in the future, and in one episode, the main character learns that in the future, ads are transmitted into people's dreams.
That's awful. It's like brainwashing.
Didn't you have ads in the 20th century?
Well, sure, but not in our dreams. Only on TV and radio. Milk cartons and t-shirts and bananas and written on the sky. But not in dreams.
Now, advertisers are always thinking of new types and places for ads because we are always learning to ignore those ads. Ben Edelman studies this at Harvard.
One sees just extreme results, 1 in 10,000 college graduates clicking a banner ad.
Some advertisers have tried coercion.
More intrusive ad formats, ads that can't be skipped.
Can't be skipped, you say? Refrigerator, open. I want to get a Coke.
I'm afraid I can't let you do that, Sabri.
What are you talking about?
You're going to have to watch this ad first. It's for these Gap sweaters.
I don't need sweaters.
That's not what the thermostat told me. The sweaters are only $19.99.
I want a Coke.
On sale now.
Oh my God. Now, the problem with coercion is that people will eventually get so annoyed they go somewhere else. So really, what our future refrigerator advertiser is going to have to do is...
be relevant.
Jeff Harmon is responsible for several famous online ad campaigns. He says people pay attention to things they need.
Google is getting so good at recognizing what you need rather than pushing it over the line.
What you need, you say? Refrigerator, open. I want to get some ice cream.
Certainly. I'm really sorry to hear about your breakup, by the way.
How did you...
Well, you're getting the ice cream. And your iPhone told me you've been listening to Hathaway on loop, so I just figured.
That's private?
It's okay. You know what'll make you feel better? Shopping. I know some great deals on sweaters.
You're always there for me, refrigerator. I wish I could date you.
Who says you can't?
In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Jill Abramson is back in print, of a sort anyway. The former executive editor of the New York Times has written an appreciation of her late colleague Arthur Gelb in the Huffington Post. There may or may not be more revelations about the circumstances of her firing last week, but it has absolutely jump-started a conversation in this country about female executives, how they're treated, and why there are so few of them. Nancy Kane from the Harvard Business School is here again to discuss topics of the day. Nancy, good to talk to you again.
Always a real pleasure, Kai.
So what is it about, I don't know, our economy, our society, that there are so few not only existing but new women CEOs in this economy?
So women now make up about, depending on how you count it, about half of the U.S. labor force. And yet only about 3 to 4% of CEOs of public companies are women. I don't think that is primarily some kind of Oliver Stone-like conspiracy. I think it is primarily because they have only recently come into the kind of positions, management, right, and then specific kind of management jobs, which really constitute the water lines that feed the big river of top leadership talent.
Break that down for me a little bit. I mean, do CEOs traditionally come from outside? Do they work their way up? I mean, I'm thinking of Mary Barra here at GM, right? She was a GM for 30-something years and now finally has her whack at the top job.
People like Mary Barra, who came in from the inside and didn't stay in HR and didn't stay in some place, a function like legal or PR, but instead was moved around into manufacturing and research and development and marketing, right? She was experienced. She had a full plate of professional positions that made her a great candidate, you know, to run this huge auto company.
How long do you think it's going to be? And I ask you, in your capacity as a historian, really, how long is it going to be before we're not talking about this anymore like it's a rarity?
I think we're talking about 10 years.
Wow.
And the reason I say that is because my own experience as a historian shows that when you have, you know, really disruptive, really important, really good social change of the kind we're talking about here, where everybody benefits from talented women, you know, stepping up and using their gifts in positions of authority, that kind of social change isn't a line. It's a curve, and it's slow to begin with, just like the adoption of, say, a new technology. And then it ratchets up, and it has all these spillover and second-order and third-order effects. You know, talented women in positions of power mentor other women. They mentor other women. And so the curve gets really steep much more quickly after a certain point, and I really believe we've hit that tipping point.
Just because I mentioned it up in the introduction to our talk, I will come back to Jill Abramson. Do you, and I'm not going to characterize it in anyway, because it's a loaded topic, but is the mere happening of an event like that, high profile as it was, and getting people to think about the role of women in the workplace, is that a helpful or a harmful thing?
You know, I think it's both, Kai. It's helpful in that, you know, it brings to light one more time that women in positions of power have to work extra hard, have to be extra good. The negative side is that it creates a kind of vicarious feeding frenzy around who's right and who's wrong and what is the real gossip here. And I'm not sure that's helping any ambitious young man or young woman nurture their gifts and take the next smart step toward, you know, living up to their dreams and the talents they have.
Nancy Kane at the Harvard Business School. Nancy, thanks.
Real pleasure.
You swing by the coffee shop in the morning, you get your latte or your mocha or your whatnot, and off you go. But pause for a moment next time to consider the cup in your hand. Fancy as the drinks that go in them are, the cups themselves have gotten fancier lately. Double-walled paper, compostable, post-consumer recycled, you name it, it's probably holding a hot beverage somewhere. The paper cup industry is edging out styrofoam, the old go-to in to-go cups. From WYSO, Lewis Wallace has more.
At the International Paper Factory in Kenton, Ohio, 16-ounce coffee cups are flying through tubes along the ceiling and landing in neat stacks. Michael Lenahan heads food service sales for the company. He says they're doubling the size of this paper cup plant in the next year.
You know, it's very exciting. We're in a growth business right now. There is increased demand for our products, and there has been for a number of years running.
The buzzword, sustainability.
Right now, it seems like the consumer is saying we want sustainably sourced products that are made from renewable resources.
Lately, some big names like McDonald's and Jamba Juice have tossed polystyrene cups and gone to paper under pressure from environmental groups. Lenahan's not a gloater, but he says, yeah, trees are renewable.
It's like farming, you know, and it's a crop.
And International Paper's various products have a lot of green labels. Sustainable forestry certification, Ecotainer, 10% post-consumer recycled. All that could make you feel vaguely good about your double macchiato to go. But foam, the kind you'd know as styrofoam, is also trying to get on that green wagon. Take Dart. You've probably seen its white foam cups around. Michael Westerfield, the head of recycling for Dart, says they get a bad rap.
Most of this is really a perception issue.
Westerfield says foam is mostly air, so it actually takes less energy to produce and ship, and it can be recycled in some places. DART even runs a few recycling plants itself. So how to sort through all this potential garbage? I call up Scott Case with UL, a product safety company that also does sustainability certification.
Some of these debates, like paper versus plastic or paper versus styrofoam, always somewhat amuse me.
Foam's got issues, but paper has hidden costs. It takes a lot of water and energy to make paper. So when you look at the whole life cycle, says Case, the answer is really bring your own cup.
A reusable mug, a reusable glass, tends to trump either of those options.
And even with paper, there's the matter of where all those billions of cups end up. Over at Rumkey Recycling, marketing director David Schwendeman points at a giant pile of bottles, cans, paper. Birds are picking through for food.
We're a middleman. We don't have a magical black box to take things and make them into something.
To recycle a product, he needs to be able to sell it to someone. And paper cups? A lot of those are coated in plastic. In most, but not all, U.S. cities, they are no more recyclable than foam.
It's probably a percentage that probably end up in the mix, but there's also a percentage that end up in the landfill.
So your coffee cup might seem greener than the next disposable thing, but here, it's just clogging up the system. In Dayton, I'm Lewis Wallace for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, in which I will go firmly on the record as saying I personally am in favor of getting rid of the penny. I've got a jar full in my office just collecting dust. I'm sure you do too. And really, over the course of a year, how much difference would rounding up or down to the nearest nickel really make? Anyway, well, as it happens, we haven't answered that question. Canada began phasing out its penny at the beginning of last year, and a Quebec man kept track of how much he was gaining or losing over the course of said year. So, grand total, he was 89 cents ahead after 365 cash transactions. So there you go. I say get rid of it. Send those cards and letters to the Mint. I don't know. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard. Engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. Have a good afternoon. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.